Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and it takes a little bit longer to get to the studio these days for Amy when she's got to shoot her way out of her Lakeview neighborhood, so she'll be here momentarily, but we begin with the debt ceiling cave by Senate Republicans. This has been building all week and, of course, culminating with McConnell offering a structured vote to Democrats to extend the debt ceiling until December. Before we get to the specifics of that fold, the build all week. President Biden assembling the usual Wall Street bankers to provide the ominous warnings of what will happen if the Democrats don't get their way. For example, Jane Fraser, who is the CEO of Citibank.
I can tell you that from an economic perspective, we need to resolve this issue very quickly. Every day of delay right now comes at an increasing price, as we've begun to see in the markets already starting last Friday. America simply cannot default on the debt, because the U.S. Treasury market is the bedrock of our financial system domestically and globally. And defaulting is going to cause lasting damage to the credibility of the United States with investors and in financial markets around the world. But as you say, the ramifications are not limited to the markets. It's already beginning to cause some damage in the economy. It will hurt consumers. It will hurt small businesses. And it's not an exaggeration to say that even small distortions in the Treasury market can cost taxpayers tens of billions of dollars over many years. Consumers can be burdened with higher borrowing costs very quickly, whether they're putting something on a credit card or they're getting a mortgage. And for small businesses trying to recover from the pandemic, this comes at a very critical time. So we just can't wait to the last minute to resolve this. We are simply put playing with fire right now. And our country has suffered so greatly over the last 2 years. The human and the economic cost of the pandemic has been wrenching. And we don't need a catastrophe of our own making to undermine the progress that is underway.
Yeah, the catastrophe of our own making is always on the side of the profligate. We want the blank checkbook. Would be the crisis of our own making, were that blank checkbook to be constrained at all. It is not the nearly $30 trillion in debt racked up and the trillions more that are on the table. So you went from the round table with the compliant central bankers who just happen to be private sector bank CEOs like Jane Fraser to Joe Manchin, waxing on about this on Wednesday when he offered a briefing to the D.C. press corps on his position with respect to the $3.5 trillion spend the fellow socialists in his party want, as well as on this issue and his call on McConnell to lead where Schumer would not.
That we should turn our society into an entitlement society. I think that we should still be a compassionate, rewarding society. I think that fares best for all of us. But compassion means taking care of those who can't take care of themselves, whether they're young, whether they've had some type of a challenge in life, whether it be mental or physical. Those are responsibilities that we have, and we can all meet those responsibilities. And I feel very strongly about that.
Right, and that was the predicate for him to say, you know, this is my position on the spend, and then but on the debt ceiling and the potential default, that boogeyman, this needs to be addressed, and I need leadership from Mitch McConnell. Janet Yellen all week, Captain Kangaroo lookalike has been on the talk shows decrying the debt ceiling, just in principle as well as in this specific instance. But remember, Janet Yellen is someone, the Treasury Secretary, yes, seriously, she is the one who, one of the ones, who wants to eliminate the debt ceiling altogether.
I think it's become increasingly damaging to America to have a debt ceiling. It's led to a series of politically dangerous conflicts that have caused Americans and global markets to question whether or not America is serious about paying its bills. It's flirting with a self-inflicted crisis.
There's that phrase again, self-inflicted crisis. Again, the crisis is not living beyond your means. The crisis is the inability to continue living beyond your means. That's the crisis in D.C. speak. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Do you agree with what McConnell and the Republicans did, mainly at the behest of Manchin? And mainly, in McConnell's own words, over concern that Manchin and Sinema were being pressured to move on the 60-vote threshold, to move down that road to eliminating the filibuster. And so McConnell wanted to preserve their opposition to blowing up the filibuster by providing this relief and enlisting, and, you know, it's the usual suspects here, enlisting some of the senators you might guess would be willing to go along with this, starting with McConnell. You have basically the transactional centers and the lame ducks, and there's overlap in those two categories. But it's Barrasso from Wyoming, Blunt from Missouri, he's gone, Capito from West Virginia, seatmate of Manchin's, Susan Collins, John Cornyn, McConnell, Murkowski, Rob Portman, he's gone, Shelby, he's gone, Thune and Rounds. Those were the 11 senators that provided the 60 votes needed in order to extend the debt ceiling as so desired by the Biden administration and, you know, all of the profligates across the political spectrum in D.C. Craig in Mount Greenwood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, David. Thanks for taking my call. Listen, no one's seen this coming. We're all worried about Manchin and Sinema taking and rolling over and getting rolled and all this kind of thing. And what the heck do they have on this guy, McConnell and everything like that? That this guy comes out of nowhere and basically bails them out like that. This is nutty stuff with these Republicans and a guy like McConnell pulling this stunt.
Yeah, thanks for the call. I don't know that it's coming out of nowhere. I mean, this is McConnell, institutional man, McConnell, transactional man, McConnell, horse trading for the things that are most prized to him, like the Senate rules, like the filibuster. But the question is he even making a proper calculation there? Manchin is dug in on this $1.5 trillion on the limitations to what he'll go along with respect to the socialist spendathon. So then he's going to flip and blow up the filibuster because of obstinance by McConnell and Senate Republicans on a debt ceiling raise. The whole thing just comes at it from the wrong angle and the rhetoric, including from Republican politicians. I mean, they essentially go along with so much of this self-inflicted crisis. They go along with this economy held hostage business. And the debt ceiling raises have been political footballs in both Republican and Democrat led governments. So this is why I'm sort of indicting the swamp in general and not limiting it just to the Democrat socialists in particular. Economy in crisis. You know, it starts from the premise, holding the economy hostage, I should say, starts from the premise that we should look at the U.S. economy through the lens of government. It's the government centrists' approach to thinking about the economic vitality of this country. You know, our prosperity runs through government's unlimited spending, which is just government's unlimited extraction and redistribution. And I just don't buy that, obviously. And I think a lot of Republicans don't either, but they, you know, acquiesce to this game of these are the things we have to do to buy us some more time to do the good things that we want to do. And of course, we never get around to those good things, that we never get around to exhibitions of restraint. As we talked with Steve Moore on the show yesterday, you know, all the sort of not raising the debt thing would do would be force you to pay out what you're taking in. The government doesn't stop taking in money. It just has, it would be constrained, at least for a period of time, with respect to what they can borrow, living beyond their means. In addition to that, not only can you pay as you go with the money you take in, you could also do something. I know this is radical.
What?
You could stop spending in areas where maybe the federal government shouldn't be spending. You could rein in some of these many hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollar social engineering gambits that the government is awash in simultaneously, and say we're going to repurpose those dollars for those critical responsibilities of government, the Social Security checks and all of the other issues that are raised for the purposes of demagoguery by those who are speaking in the parlance of self-inflicted crisis.
Yeah, they're just not disciplined enough to do so. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Mary Ellen in Crete.
Yeah, hi, Dan. Hi, Amy. I agree with you, Dan. But the Democrats continue with this rhetoric, like you said. But I knew Mitch McConnell was going to collapse, because he just, that's how he is. And all the Democrats needed to do was do the budget reconciliation, which they always talk about. And
that's
make
right.
It the only 50, you know, so, I mean, Manchin and Sinema were on board with raising the debt ceiling, and then it got Harris. So why did, I don't understand why McConnell even said that.
Thanks for the call, Mary. Well, again, that's right. They could have done that. And Biden said it the other day. The real reason is because they don't want it to have people have to take hundreds of votes that may be problematic for them, particularly senators running for re-election. That's effectively what he said. The Wall Street Journal opined on this, catching it. We discussed it. And so that's the reason. So McConnell, what does McConnell get out of it? You preserve Manchin's commitment to only $1.5 trillion? You preserve Manchin's commitment to not blow up the filibuster. You know, if Manchin wants to do an about face and blow himself up by doing 180s on any of the positions he's repeatedly taken, digging in further and further with each passing day, well, then go ahead. You know, this idea that McConnell is doing something. I'm not, you know what you would hear. I'm not rescuing the Manchin or Sinema. I'm not rescuing the Democrats. I'm doing this for the greater good of the country. I don't think so. I don't think, 1.5 versus 3.5, the perceived protection of the filibuster against these neo-Jacobins that comprise the Democrat Socialist caucuses in both chambers. You're not doing that to protect the country from anything. You're doing that in the interest of slowing the dissembling of the country by these individuals. But that's not good enough, and that doesn't draw a bright enough line. This is, an existential fight, so behave accordingly. How about that as an approach? Mike in Plano.
Hey, guys. You know, the thing with this is there was no reason for them to cave, because Biden's pulling now in the 30s. The Democrat agenda is basically collapsing across the country, across many different groups, pretty much everybody. So the only reason McConnell's doing this is obviously to appease the big donor base of Wall Street and things like that. But here's the thing. We got to have conservative media start promoting primary opponents. And I'm not talking about you guys specifically. I'm just talking about in general. I mean, you had people out there last year like Laura Ingraham and Mike Gallagher and all these people who call themselves great conservatives telling voters go out and re-elect John Cornyn. Why? We know what John Cornyn's record is. It's absolutely atrocious. There's no reason to keep sending these guys back over and over again if they're going to consistently betray the base.
Thanks for the call, Mike.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We've talked a lot about violence run amok in Chicago. All of the institutions that bear responsibility for the lack of public safety in Chicagoland. And even, you know, we tell stories, but sometimes I think it's helpful to just zero in on a singular story and also hear from the victim to really drive it home. And perhaps to animate people to demand better. I put a question mark at the end of that. I don't know if that's a thing in Chicago, if that ever will be a thing, if that's a possibility. But
I just think people are so numb and just it's just numbers now. Like, but who are the people behind the numbers? Well, who are the families that have to suffer?
Yeah, well, here's one of them. This father and son driving home from a Blackhawks game last week. They sat down for an interview with Evelyn Holmes at ABC 7. And here's the thing, too. Their faces were not provided. They weren't shown because they fear retribution. By all accounts, this shooting on the Eisenhower was a random shooting. They're still so afraid of retribution if they go tell their story on local TV about what happened. Afraid of retribution, even though it was this random thing, sort of speaks to the culture of fear that is begotten by the culture of violence.
Last Wednesday, the two were heading home from a Blackhawks game on the Ike. That's when the victim's son says they were targeted by another driver for some unknown reason as they neared Kedzie Avenue.
The gun was pointed sideways like something out of a movie, and I saw the first two shots and got down.
I was trying to make sure that my son was out of the way. I just couldn't avoid it.
His dad had been hit in the neck by one of the bullets that pierced the windshield and dash, but still managed to pull over. That's when he says his military training kicked in. He called 911 and applied pressure to the wound until paramedics arrived. Doctors say his quick thinking probably saved his dad's life.
If it wasn't for them doing what they did, my father would be dead.
My son's a hero.
Illinois State Police are still looking for the shooter as they beef up patrols in hopes of keeping other drivers safe. After more than 6 hours of surgery and several days in the ICU, Dad is finally recovering at home, but struggles to heal from the trauma.
You don't want to be afraid to live, but you have to have your, you have to be aware of your surroundings.
Oh, that is so, you don't want to be afraid to live?
And he's one of the lucky ones. He's luckier than that Orland Park special ed teacher who was shot and killed on the Dan Ryan coming back from a Sox game. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Afraid to live in Chicago. Is that you?
That is me. I've lived here, what, since 1996? Well, I grew up here but came back and have pretty much stayed in the same neighborhood, you know, in Berteau, did that whole Irving Park, Ashland area. And I am afraid for my kids. You know, they have homecoming tonight. You think I'm going to sleep at all? Worried about them? And I'm not worried about them drinking or driving or doing something stupid. I'm worried about them getting shot or somebody in the school or other kids at other homecomings throughout the city this weekend. I mean, when you say goodbye to your players too, it's like, please be safe, make smart choices, but be safe, be aware of your surroundings. Like, yeah. Okay. But it's real, and it's at our front doorsteps.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, in my neighborhood, when I'm out and about, I carry most places most of the time. I'm, you know, driving on these expressways, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I've got a concealed carry permit.
Good for you.
Just say that. And so, but to that gentleman's point who survived that shooting, is this any way to live? And I mean, some of this is repetitive, but I don't know, repeat for the purposes of trying to drive, you know, some nails through some concrete here intellectually. You've had a flight from Chicago of middle and lower income black families over the last decade from some of these shooting gallery neighborhoods, which is now you know, potentially every neighborhood in Chicago, and that's a huge change, as we know. But that they are fleeing from those neighborhoods, those who can get out too, because they don't want to live in fear, because they have the same concerns for their children that you're describing for your children tonight at homecoming, Amy. And they just want to live. And I mean, it's just sort of the first threshold that one must clear is where I'm living safe for me and my family. And if it's not, then I can't be here. And I think that's a decision. That's a question a lot more people are putting to themselves, and a decision they're making in the affirmative to leave. In other words, I know the number one reason people in Illinois are leaving Illinois now is taxes and the business climate, all economic related. But I think the number one reason that more people who hadn't considered leaving Chicago until, say, the last couple of years are leaving is not economic, although that probably factors in. It's public safety. Because, I mean, unless you – Ken Griffin this week, I was about to say unless you're really wealthy and you can squirrel yourself away, but that's not even true. Ken Griffin at the Economic Club of Chicago this week talking about how the security detail in front of his condo building where he's got, you know, three floors of some $40 million his security detail, there was an attempted hijacking of his security detail. Now, it didn't succeed because it's his security detail.
And they were armed to the teeth. But yeah, still, I mean, the fact that they're so brazen and bold, they'll just go up to anybody, anywhere. They want your car, they'll try and take your car. And that's why they're going to Bucktown a lot. Bucktown's by the Kennedy. Easy way to get out. And they want their fancy cars.
Carjacking's
they want the Lexus, the Audis.
Carjacking's up 100% in Bucktown.
I talked to someone yesterday, and she said, I live in Bucktown, and I just don't even drive my car. Because I'm so afraid. I take public transportation. I'm so worried about getting carjacked.
I mean, again, there's the story that broke finally earlier this week after they tried to hide it from the public. Preckwinkle's security detail, a Cook County Forest Preserve cop, an attempted carjacking in Hyde Park. He's got a police plate on his car. Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Yeah. And the fact, too, that officer tried to cover it up and not tell the government that he shot somebody. That's an ancillary issue, but still.
Yeah, but that's so this is what's going on. And you know, and then you just have, in response, you have, talk about misinformation. You get misinformation, you get finger pointing, and the shootings continue. The carjackings continue. The turnstile justice, courtesy of Kim Fox, continues. Ron in Salem, Wisconsin.
Hey, good morning, guys. I grew up in Chicago my whole life. I moved out about 30 years ago, moved to Wisconsin about 20 years ago. I'm a union construction worker. I work in all Illinois and in Chicago. I never thought I'd see the day where I turned down a job. About when that shooting happened with the bartender taking his daughter to school, I was working at a public school right near there, and I just finished the job. I'd pass by there every morning. And after that job, I was offered another job, and I turned it down. And I never thought I'd turn down a job in Chicago. Yeah, I got 2 years left, and I hope I can stay alive.
Thanks for the call, Ron. Appreciate it. Terry in Rogers Park.
Yeah, do you think maybe Mayor Lightfoot, Police Chief Brown, and Kim Fox give a pass to rioters and gangbangers from prosecution because they're afraid of retaliation? Just like the victims and witnesses to these crimes are?
Thanks for the call, Terry. I'm not sure that they're afraid of retaliation. I mean, they've got
strong security details.
Yeah, Lori Lightfoot's got a veritable bunker around her house in Ravenswood or wherever the hell it is.
Pritzker has Illinois State Police and other supplemental security guards.
Yeah, I mean, not to say that... there's, you know, no reason to be concerned, but I don't think that's motivating. And I think it's much sicker than that, right? What's motivating their policy responses is politics, identitarian politics. I mean, these are the people that told you that, you know, the rioting was justified or the rioting was not a COVID concern because the cause was righteous.
Right.
These are the people that told the police to stand down during the two riots last year and just act as sort of recorders of events, rather than arresting people that were committing acts of violence. They're the symbolic takings crowd. They're the, you know, indirect reparations crowd. I think it's all identitarian politics. They're the systemic racists, yep. Right? Systemic racism is the problem. The police are the problem.
They're the ones who went after cops who had a half a bag of popcorn and coffee after working 72 hours straight. That's who those people are.
Yeah, or some cop gives somebody the bird. I mean, it's just that, you know, that they took an antagonistic position towards police from the outset, rooted in identitarian ideology, triple threat, self-described. And this is what you get. And now they're sort of backtracking, at least rhetorically, to talk about law and order and people who commit acts of violence need to be removed from the streets and there's no place for violence and all the usual, anodyne phrases you hear from politicians who've lost control of a situation or, in this case, a city. But, you know, you can't put this parade of horribles back in line once you unleash them. I mean, this has been happening. You know, this is not recent. Again, this is 200 plus expressway shootings just this year. We know the year-over-year stats. We've gone over them over and over again. You know, if you've been in Chicago or even just have friends in Chicago, restaurateurs in Chicago, you know what the situation has been like with restaurants and bars and River North and some of the entertainment districts since the lockdowns. You know what it's been. It's been a catastrophe. And it's been utter lawlessness. And even restaurants basically feeding cops to keep them in and around the restaurants, you can't stop it. I mean, that melee on State Street, State in Illinois, just a couple of weeks ago. The shootout in Austin a week ago Friday. The Miami Vice car chase through Westtown last week.
Or the one on Monday night on Irving Park, 90 miles per hour, 32 shots fired, boom, 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 boom.
Right.
And if you're a parent, I sat Peyton and Eli down. I said, I want you to watch this because this happened right there. And I just they knew that, oh, yeah, we saw it at school. And I said, you have to be so careful and so vigilant when you're driving. Just listen. If you hear cars driving quickly or fast, you hear the motor revving, just get out of the way. Pull over. Let them through.
Yeah. Make sure you have your mask on, though. Tim in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan and Amy, I love your show. I listen to you every morning. I wish I could remember where I read this, but all this stuff happening in these major cities where these DAs are funded by Soros and they let everybody go, so crime skyrockets, and then good people, Republicans that got jobs and other Democrats that are conservative, they move out. Because why are you going to stay in an environment like that? And what it does is it takes these major cities, turns them into Democratic strongholds, and like in Illinois, whichever way the Chicagoland area goes, it carries the state. So now you've got a Democratic, and they're after the Electoral College votes, because now they'll run the presidential elections. You know, so I wish I could remember where I saw it. I don't remember. I'm sorry about that, but this is all orchestrated, and just look for Soros and his money, and there you go.
Thanks for the call, Tim. Yeah, we've talked a lot about all of the DAs and state's attorneys that whose campaigns have largely been financed by Soros. There's definitely a play there. I mean, what's his purpose? Bail reform? Police reform? Probably bigger than that. I mean, I don't know if I would go so far as Cloward Piven 2.0, but I raised it, so I'm contemplating going that far because to continue to turn out, remember, 45 individuals this year so far who are facing felony charges, committed a felony while on ankle monitoring, awaiting the adjudication of their felony charges. I mean, if you have these repeat offenders, and we've talked about so many cases where this is not, you know, a one-off felony, an unlawful use of a weapon charge, and then they ankle monitor them. And these are habitual, repeat, right, violent offenders, gun offenders, against the backdrop of all this, let's get illegal guns off the streets, and they turn the illegal gun offenders back on the streets.
And one shot at a cop.
There's something more to this than just the, we're striking a blow against the systemically racist police departments and criminal justice system. There's something more. Tony and Roselle.
Good morning. I just wanted to call in and relate to you that I grew up, I spent 27 years in Humboldt Park. So hearing gunshots or knowing people who had been shot seems very common to me. And eventually I made it out of the city, like an escape from Alcatraz. And I took my son to the old neighborhood recently just to drive by and show him where I grew up. And there were some people that owned a small store there. And it was open. I went in. The guy recognized me. He asked me how my mother was, my sister. I asked him about the neighborhood. My son was just looking around the neighborhood. He couldn't believe where I grew up. And the guy behind the counter lifted his shirt, and he had a gun. And as we drove home, he was just silent. He goes, "Was that an actual gun?" I go, "They live in the city, in the neighborhood, where they sell alcohol. Everyone's carrying. Everyone was carrying when it was illegal 25 years ago. This is the reality that people have to go through." And I just want to point out, I don't want to take too much time, that the stress, the PTSD, the effects that this kind of violence has on everybody in the city is immeasurable. To this day, a car drives past my house in quiet suburban Roselle. The second time it passes by, I notice. And nobody else notices. I'm like, how did you not notice that guy went by twice? Mm. Oh, that's right, because cars that circle the block where I grew up were up to no good. You develop a little bit of paranoia, a little bit of... There's a psychological effect to these people that have lived with us in these neighborhoods for decades that just now people outside those neighborhoods are getting a taste of, and they're all up in arms finally.
Good call. Thanks for that, Tony. Appreciate it. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Dave Chappelle just dropped his latest stand-up special on Netflix called The Closer. Jason Whitlock is over the moon about it, calling it, the bravest thing that he's seen in forever. I'm not so sure.
Have you watched it yet?
I have. It's good, but it just harkens back to a time when we appreciated comedy and we appreciated that comedy is not supposed to have real limits in terms of targets. So, is Chappelle doing something more daring than did Jackie Mason or Don Rickles? No, I don't think so. I think the fact that Jason Whitlock's reaction to Chappelle is what I described is more indicative of where we find ourselves in this country right now. But before we get to Chappelle, because he goes after, the sacred cows of the identitarians, the LGBT community, Jews, Asians, but particularly LGBTQ. And that's drawn, of course, the most vociferous reaction from from reviews that pan the show on NPR to GLAAD, the Gay Lesbian Anti-Defamation Alliance thing, up in arms and calling for, whatever, I don't know.
To be yanked
to be
off the...
gulagged or something.
Do they want to take him down?
But he uses high-profile cases, and you'll hear them, DaBaby and J.K. Rowling, to talk identitarian politics in the LGBTQ spectrum. But the reason they resonate is because of low-profile incidents in everyday life everyday people have to experience. That's what gives it the audience. What happened if it was just intemperate comments from DaBaby or a preposterous reaction to J.K. Rowling, if those were just isolated incidents, this would have no audience. But it's what you're about to hear. What you're about to hear is the reason Chappelle has an audience for this material. This is trans operative Eden in quotation marks, Torres, filming himself at a Sonic in Houston, like Sonic the fast food joint. Accosting, I don't know if this guy is the manager of the Sonic or the owner of the Sonic.
Yeah.
But Eden felt that he was mistreated by the Sonic employees. So he tracked down this superior that was on site and started to give him chapter and verse. Listen to this back and forth.
That's why.
I mean, I'll pull.
And why you want to record me?
Because your entire staff has been calling me sir.
Okay. Do you want to park?
Why don't you tell me what we can do now?
No, because I can do the same thing with you.
Okay. But your entire staff has been calling me sir the entire time.
Okay. What do you want to be called? Then tell me.
What about me looks like a sir right now?
Maybe the 5 o'clock shadow.
Okay.
Okay. Can we please move to the sign?
No.
Maybe the man hands? I don't know. Sir.
What?
Sir.
Look, I'm sorry, and I apologize for what happened, okay? If they did that, or, I'm sorry. What else can I tell you, I mean, ma'am? What else can I tell you?
What?
I mean, if you're, can we please move to the
side? If I'm a what?
Can you please move to the side?
If I'm a what?
I didn't say anything, okay? Don't try to put any words in my mouth, okay?
Okay.
Okay, look.
Let's see what this
if they call you a sir, I don't know what they did then.
Because they saw the name on my credit card, and they were not being nice people.
Well, I mean, they saw your name on the credit card. What do you want them to tell you?
That has nothing to do with it. There could be someone in the back that they don't see. That's paying.
Okay, ma'am.
So why would they intentionally do that? Can you tell me what your location has done to be transcompetent? Because clearly they are not.
There's our new term, Dan.
Ma'am, believe me, you know, whatever you're saying or whatever you're trying to do with this.
I'm not trying to do anything.
Yes, because you're recording.
No, because.
Okay, you're recording. You want to put it on social media?
No, because I have been faced with discrimination
from
your staff.
Bye.
I'm so sorry that you feel discriminated, but I mean, we have employees here.
That
are gay. If you're saying that they're gay, I mean they're here. They work here.
So and I'm not gay.
I don't say that.
We're
you
talking
are.
About my gender identity, okay, well, not my sexuality.
Well, I mean, but like I said, I mean, or
do you understand what I'm saying?
Look, okay, like I tell you, we don't need to discriminate anybody in here. Okay, I'm so sorry if you feel discriminated.
It's those sort of interactions that give rise to, you know, this observation from Chappelle about DaBaby, Da rapper DaBaby, who got in some hot water for, you know, graphic comments he made about gay people at a concert. Okay, they were. This is not a defense of the comments of DaBaby, but what Chappelle has to say about the reaction to these comments versus, oh, geez, I don't know, other incidents in DaBaby's past is instructive.
A lot of the LGBTQ community doesn't know DaBaby's history. He's a wild guy. He once shot a and killed him in Walmart. Oh, this is true. Google it. DaBaby shot and killed a in Walmart in North Carolina. Nothing bad happened to his career. Do you see where I'm going with this? In our country, you can shoot and kill a nigga, but you better not hurt a gay person's feelings.
That's a true story. DaBaby did shoot and kill somebody in a Walmart, and he was initially charged, and the charges were later dropped. But
get
into the details of the case, but it's very his story in that shooting is very questionable, but nonetheless,
the larger point is that, you know, he didn't lose a career or anything happened to him for that, but he did because he made comments about the LGBTQ, and I don't even know what comments he made.
Dua Lipa wasn't distancing herself from DaBaby because he was involved in shooting and killing a black man, but because he said, you know, some stupid things about gay men in particular at a concert, you know, he has to, you know, get feel the full treatment of outrage, and he's got to go through the whole reconciliation process and, you know, salt himself away in some enclave where he'll be properly instructed as to, you know, the wonders of the LGBTQ community and so forth, unadulterated wonders. And so Chappelle also took up the case of J.K. Rowling. We've talked about this on the program. Remember her being under assault for saying, you know, basically that men and women are different.
And they've canceled people that are more powerful than me. They canceled J.K. Rowling. My God, J.K. Rowling wrote all the Harry Potter books by herself. She sold so many books, the Bible worries about her. And they canceled her because she said in an interview, and this is not exactly what she said, but effectually, she said gender was a fact. And then the trans community got mad and started calling her a TERF. I didn't even know what that was. But I know that trans people make up words to win arguments. So I looked it up. TERF is an acronym. Stands for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminists. This is a real thing. This is a group of women that hate transgender. They don't hate transgender women, but they look at trans women the way we blacks might look at blackface. It offends them. Like, ooh, this is doing an impression of me. Now, I shouldn't speak on this because I am not a woman, nor am I trans. But as we've established, I am a feminist. That's right. I'm Team TERF. I agree, man. Gender is a fact. You have to look at it from a woman's perspective. Look at it like this. Caitlyn Jenner, whom I've met, wonderful person. Caitlyn Jenner was voted Woman of the Year. Her first year as a woman. Ain't that something? Beat every in Detroit. She's better than all of you. Gender is a fact. This is a fact. Every human being in this room, every human being on Earth, had to pass through the legs of a woman to be on Earth. That is a fact.
Oh, my gosh.
And that is what is considered bold and cutting edge and subversive right now. And this is what Chappelle is getting so much heat from. This is what he's getting so much heat for from LGBTQ, the entire alphabet. You know it. And if you don't, Justin Trudeau up there north of the border will help you.
I will never apologize for standing up for an LGBT.
It's a tongue twister, no question about it. Dave Chappelle, saving comedy, saving free thought, or somebody who's insulated because of his wealth and notoriety from real consequences, the way that, say, that poor manager or owner of that Sonic in Houston having to deal with trans activist Eden Torres is not.
And Torres, I mean, what a just it was horrible and ridiculous what he's trying to get that employee fired. He's in the drive-thru. The employee doesn't see his, her face and reads on the credit card that it's a mister and does the nice polite thing by calling him sir. He didn't know because he looks like a man. I watched the video. I mean, it looks like a man with a wig on.
Thank you, human. Right. What would you like to order, human? Right.
Well, he's just bullying him because he didn't bow down and affirm his trans ideology. Of course.
And the guy had him, the manager or owner had him sussed out. You just want to film this, put this on social media to make a big point, to make me or this establishment look like we're discriminating or we're not trans competent. And this is a bunch of nonsense. If you're offended, I'm sorry, but my employees aren't bad people.
And some are even gay.
And you just said they read your name on a credit card. So, you know, when they see Joe Torres or whatever his name is, they assume a man, you know, so nail him to a cross already.
People make mistakes, you know, come on.
Well, I'm not sure it was a mistake. The only mistake I saw in that video was that aggressive trans activist. That's the mistake I saw. Trying to jackpot his neighbor, right. Being unfair and uncharitable, particularly when the guy apologized about four times in 2 minutes. Joe in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you know, in the immortal words of Dennis Miller, you know, you've arrived as a race, gender, person, whatever you want to call yourself. When somebody makes a joke about you, and you could laugh about it. You know, give all the Irish jokes you want, you know, out there. And if I think it's funny, I'll laugh. You know,
absolutely.
They got to cut this crap out.
Absolutely. I just wonder what impact Chappelle will have. I think it'll be fleeting. I don't think this is going to, you know, spark some,
no.
You know, Dave Chappelle
boycott.
Said it, so no. I can, or Dave, or, you know, refer to Dave Chappelle if you're offended by, you know, good natured ribbing or just an actual substantive position like sex is a real thing. Men and women are different and you don't just get to play dress up and change your biology. That's a real position presented in a comedic fashion. I don't know if that's going to spark a lot of people being so bold. Tom in Schererville.
Yeah, I can't help but thinking right now in the back of my mind, I'm thinking of Andrew Dice Clay and when he had his comedy routine. How well would he do in today's environment? I keep wondering that.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Yeah, I, you know, saying there's a difference between men and women gets you excoriated, as Chappelle's finding out. I don't know how the dirty limericks would go over these days. You know, good question. Dave in Wakanda.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. There's a difference between a man and a woman. Now, if you're a man, you can lop it off and you can even take estrogen and grow a pair of boobs, but you can never get rid of your Adam's apple. That's what I have to say.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. Clay and Wheeling.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, how interesting is it? You know, just to think about it. In 10 years, we have gone from two men want to be they just want to be married to now you have to accept my pronouns or I'm going to have you and your entire staff fired.
Yep.
For discrimination. How scary is that? As a notion that we make these radical shifts in our society just based off of somebody's feelings.
Well, that's thanks for the call, Clay. That's what happens, and that's how fast it can go when you countenance a lie and you indulge the sentimental. That's exactly right. I mean, there's no better case study than this ever growing alphabet soup of gender identitarians.
And now they even have, you know, TERF if you're against transgender women. But I always say, you know, the ones that I know, I said, you think it's easier being a woman? Okay, you'll find out. You'll see.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, all right, take it easy there, Helen Reddy. so on the substantive matter here,
yes.
Abigail Schreier published an interview this week that's really important. Two top gender medical providers, a vaginoplasty expert and gender surgeon named Dr. Marcy Bowers and a child psychologist at the University of California, San Francisco Gender Clinic, Dr. Erica Anderson. For the first time in the United States, top gender medical providers collectively acknowledged four facts. Early puberty blockade can lead to significant surgical complication and also permanent sexual dysfunction. Number one,
okay.
For those parents like Charlize Theron who want to let your four-year-old
decide what gender they're going to be.
Yeah, and then participate in the mutilation of your children, for goodness sakes. That's number one. Two, peer and social media influence do seem to play a role in encouraging the current unprecedented spike in trans identification by teen girls. Three, the World Professional Association of Trans Health, and both of these doctors are board members, has been excluding doctors who question current medical protocols to its detriment. Excluding dissent. Expert professional dissent. But the naivete is the fourth. In Bowers' words, Dr. Bowers, when you block puberty, the problem is that a lot of the kids are orgasmically naive. So in other words, if you never had an orgasm pre-surgery and then your puberty is blocked, it's very difficult to achieve that afterwards. And I think that I consider that a big problem, actually. It's kind of an overlooked problem that in our informed consent of children undergoing puberty blockers, we've in some respects overlooked that a little bit. So permanent sexual dysfunction, and this is not for the purposes of the prurient. This is for the purpose of thinking about you're preventing people from having families. You're preventing people from being sexually healthy adults. That's what you're doing. That's, you know, it's criminal. It's certainly immoral, especially if you do it knowingly. And now these doctors are saying, essentially, that if they're not doing it knowingly, they're doing it because of willful blindness and crowding out of dissent. And there's nothing funny about that. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know, this show isn't for everybody. If you're not interested in the truth, if you're not interested in having a conversation on the merits, then don't listen to this show.
On AM560.
Because there's no place for you here.
The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the big guy was in our fair Elk Grove Village yesterday at Clayco construction site where they're building a Microsoft data center. And he's touting the vaccine mandates he's imposed. Didn't want to do it. Felt he owed it to America.
Well, it's going to help the economy. That's what he says.
Yeah, it's a great stimulus. I got that. But also, does he have the science right on vaccinations as we understand them and the vaccinated?
We have to beat this thing. So while I didn't race to do it right away, that's why I've had to move toward requirements that everyone get vaccinated where I had the authority to do that. That wasn't my first instinct. My administration is now requiring federal workers to be vaccinated. We've also required federal contractors to be vaccinated. If you have a contract with the federal government working for the federal government, you have to be vaccinated. We're requiring active duty military to be vaccinated. We're making sure healthcare workers are vaccinated, because if you seek care at a healthcare facility, you should have the certainty that the people providing that care are protected from COVID and cannot spread it to you.
Natural immunity would help with that, but they're not considering it.
Is that right? Is that right? If you're vaccinated, you can't spread?
Another big lie coming out of Washington, D.C.
Well, that's what he just said.
Yeah, I know.
For more on the topic, pleased to be joined again by Dr. Chad Savage. He's founder of Your Choice Direct Care, policy advisor for the Heartland Institute as well. Dr. Savage.
Well, morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. How are you guys?
Good. Does Joe Biden have that right? You know, the reason I'm mandating the vaccine for healthcare institutions, well, like Kaiser Permanente, which just suspended 2,000 employees for not getting vaccinated. Yeah. The reason I'm doing that is because you should be able to go to a doctor, see a healthcare professional, and know that they can't transmit the virus.
Well, the funny thing about Joe Biden is actually he was right on the mandate at one point in time, but that's not the current time. Back in December, as you probably remember, he actually assured Americans prior to taking office that he would not require, you know, create a national mandate for vaccines, and yet he seems to be doing just that now.
Well, yeah, he failed and Kaiser Permanente, and he had to, right.
Yeah, so it's human behavior, you know, that everything is attributed to the virus. But unfortunately, you know, that's a form of coercion, right? You know, you get this vaccine or lose your job. And he's interestingly enough described it as a choice, that when people were put up with the mandate that you get this or you lose your job, he bragged that they chose to get vaccinated. Well, that's not a traditional choice. It's coercion, and coercion is not persuasion, and condescension is not counseling. And you know, Kaiser's not the only one that suffered this. Across the nation, hospitals are reporting substantial losses of personnel. Now, people will say in the aggregate it's not that much, maybe 2-3% of hospital staff. But that's not just a 2-3% does not simply result in a delay of accessing care by 2-3%. If you go to a saturated emergency department now, that 2-3% of decreased staff could result in many hours of delayed access to care, which actually can result in not only just harm economically, but that can result in hurt or even dead people, delayed surgeries, cancer screenings, ER wait times, and the like.
But also, again, what he said about the vaccinated. I want to be clear, because we alternate between explaining away breakthrough cases, for example, and transmission within the vaccinated community, for example, while at the same time hearing pronouncements that it's a veritable force field around you?
No, certainly not that. I mean, it may reduce your chance of contracting the virus. You may be less severely ill if you do get it. But there are clear examples and cases of people who have spread it once they've been vaccinated. And that was a big issue that came up several months ago when, to the surprise and admission of Dr. Walensky, who's the head of the CDC, that viral loads in the nostrils of people who were vaccinated and were actually but became sick were equivalent to those who became sick and were unvaccinated.
Wow. Well, then my biggest concern is they're going to start with the two shots and then they're going to go to a third, and that you could lose your job if you don't get the booster shot. Do you see that happening?
It's certainly possible, and you know, talk about a lot of consternation. The boosters are created one, a lot of turmoil even within the government itself, as you guys are, I'm sure, aware. The CDC and the FDA committees, recommendation committees on the vaccine did not necessarily 100% agree with each other. Dr. Walensky actually overruled her. Yeah, she overruled her own advisory committee, and that's why it's now being mandated for healthcare workers, because they actually recommended that the booster not be mandated to healthcare workers. And then she went up above that and said, no, at least for Pfizer, that they were going to require that. And, you know, this can have a spiral effect, too, because people talk about 2 to 3%. Again, sounds small, but we're at around a 5.5% unemployment rate right now. But if you were to tack 3% onto that and make it 8.5%, you're looking at an entirely different economy. So, you know, and it is absolute large numbers. You get a hospital system that loses 2,000 employees. You know, that's very significant. And these people now are no longer in the productive aspect of the economy and are in the, could be consuming resources on a dependent dependent side of the economy instead of actually contributing.
We got a new mask study that's being bandied about, a mask study from CDC, Arizona Schools, that purports to conclude that the likelihood of outbreaks is 3.5 times in schools that don't have masks versus schools that where the kids are masked. This is being referenced, the 3.5x everywhere now since the Sunday talkies all week. And yet, actually, if you look into the study, it seems like it's fairly specious. Certainly, it's problematic. The Arizona schools, you had the setup rigged to favor masking, as masked close contact kids don't need to test, but unmasked close contact kids do. Also, unmasked schools were much larger, much more opportunity for spread than the masked schools that were much smaller. One researcher pouring through this suggested the study stinks to high heaven of data manipulation.
Yeah. I mean, you're seeing that in a lot of it. It seems like there's almost a desperation to try to make studies show that these things work in the real world. Most of the studies on the masking have shown that in a hypothetical setting, kinetic studies, watching how particles move in space, that they do seem to have an impact. And then they project what type of reduction that would have in transmission. But they, up until just recently, had no randomized real-world prospective studies that showed a benefit. And only a few have come up recently though I'm not familiar with that specific study, have shown an exceedingly modest benefit. And even the authors themselves were suggesting that the results may not be generalizable, meaning that they may be an interesting study finding, but may not be applicable to the broader population, which means that, for lack of a better way of saying it, they're kind of shrug-worthy, which kind of goes back to, if masks make a difference at all, it's probably on the margins, a couple of percent here or there. But actually, there was an interesting and very concerning study out of Brown University just recently, which seems to be supported by Cornell as well, suggesting that infants' neurodevelopment is 2 standard deviations off of the norm, and that started in late 2020 and has persisted to today, which would be equivalent of basically having someone at an IQ of 100 going down to 80, which is really, really dramatic. And despite the claim by many who say, well, you know, we can mask, we can interrupt education and such, but we'll just make it up later, they've shown that people who have deficits, children who have deficits that are persistent to 2 years, many meantime, those are very hard to reverse, and they don't recognize that neuroplasticity is not perpetual through life. There are important developmental milestones when the brain is developing where we have to hit certain milestones at certain points. Otherwise, we may permanently or very delayed develop those skills at all. So this is really concerning. They admittedly didn't know if it was a mask, so that was one of the hypotheses, was that parents wearing masks, school, daycare centers and such, if they're even allowed to go there, wear masks. But these interventions are by no means benign. We have impacts that we have not fully understood or realized yet from these interventions, and we have to act with humility, which is something that's not currently being done.
Do you think it's going to be a permanent part of schooling, masking?
I sure hope not. Eventually, we want to get back to normal. And if you consider normal seeing people's faces, it seems like just on a personal level, it seems dehumanizing to hide behind masks. Expressive communication is really important. And it's interesting, when we talk to each other, our brains are incredibly active. They do these PET scans, these studies in the brain. And when we converse, our entire brain lights up. And we've actually shown that there's an inverse relationship between things like dementia and social interaction. So if you have a bunch of people that you talk to regularly, you actually are less likely to develop dementia. So these human interactions, they're the spice of life. They're what many times gives us joy and meaning, but they also have medical benefit and potentially may, obviously improve intellectual development on the young age and may maintain intellectual development on the back end in the form of preventing dementia.
Dr. Marty Makary from Johns Hopkins writes in the Wall Street Journal, in favor of the FDA moving with all due speed to provide emergency use authorization to Merck for its antiviral pill, molnupiravir. The study suggests, studies by Merck, that it's safe, reduces the risk of the direst outcomes from COVID by 50%. Are you ready to prescribe molnupiravir if the FDA provided EUA for that drug?
Yeah, well, it's certainly interesting. I'd have to see more of the data. The only reports that have been released so far are press releases, so we actually don't have the data. I'm obviously very encouraged and excited for any real-world pill-based treatments that you can do as an outpatient. So I'm definitely open to the possibility. We need to see the data. The same is true on the boosters. We're going off of press reports on boosters. The childhood vaccines under age 12 are based on press reports. Most of this data is not publicly available yet. And actually, if I can digress to the childhood vaccines, interestingly enough, they're making a mistake we made in the 2000s. They're going off of what are called surrogate markers of disease. In the 2000s, a prominent doctor at the Cleveland Clinic named Eric Topol said, hey, we're introducing these new diabetes pills. Sure, they improve the sugar numbers, but the reason we worry about diabetes isn't because of numbers on a piece of paper are abnormal. It's because that results in heart attack, strokes, premature death, blindness, etc. He said, we're not looking at the outcomes. We're looking at surrogate markers that could relate to outcomes, but are themselves not necessarily outcomes. And the drug he was complaining about at the time eventually was pulled off the market because it actually increased heart disease instead of reducing it. Well, he won that argument. He testified in front of Congress, and we started really much more focusing appropriately on outcomes data. Well, now we're retreading in the same errors that were made at that time. Now, fast forward to 2021, and instead of looking at the vaccines in children and outcomes data, they're looking at viral loads, antibody titers. So they say, they spark the antibodies. Okay, great. That very plausibly would reduce infections. But does it actually? It may. It very well may. I'm not discounting the fact that it could. But we're jumping ahead of the horse in a very low-risk population without actually knowing fully all the negatives that could come from those vaccines and without actually proving the positive in outcomes. And they're using, once again, the emergency use authorization, which is intended to be used in true, dire, time-sensitive emergencies. And at least in children in that age range, it certainly is not that. We suffer 58,000 hospitalizations a year from RSV. And it's not treated with anywhere near the severity or urgency, and that's only in children under five. But that's not treated anywhere near the severity or urgency as we're seeing COVID, which you could argue is perhaps less impactful to children than RSV.
Well, that's really useful historical perspective. And so based on what you just said, then at this juncture, you would not endorse getting your 5 to 11-year-old vaccinated, even if the FDA gives Pfizer EUA on that.
Yeah. So with the risk of being censored and having my license pulled, yeah, which right. unfortunately is occurring to doctors who express their honest opinion, and I am encouraging cautious and scientific inquiry and discussion, not threat, and which stymies intellectual pursuits. And
well, you can't go to school in L.A. if you don't get vaccinated.
Yeah. So think about that. They're not mandating it, but they do mandate school, right? You can't just say, well, I'm going to have my kids at home and I'm not going to do any form of schooling. I guess you could theoretically homeschool if you have that capability. But you're legally obligated to school your child. But if you do send them, they're going to now make it legally obligated. You use the vaccine, which means they're legally obligating the vaccine. So, it's the circuitous route, but they're mandating it through several steps.
Yeah, well, that's going to be a source of litigation, I suspect, particularly based on what you said about where we're at in understanding the impacts on children 5 through 11 from the vaccine. Dr. Chad Savage, founder of Your Choice Direct Care, policy advisor for the Heartland Institute as well. Dr. Savage, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yep. Pleasure.
Thank you. And keep in mind, they're not vaccinating 5 to 11-year-olds in Europe. And the doctor joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy and the left needs America to be racist. And if it's not, they'll ensure that it is. Atlanta, suburb of Atlanta, called Douglasville, Georgia. At least 7 black families in one subdivision began receiving letters earlier this year claimed to have come from a man who described himself as a member of the KKK. This news report from March describes the letters as containing frightening and racist terroristic threats. One man who received one of the letters told the station there in suburban Atlanta, it described killing whole families, murdering children, burning down homes of the recipients. The letters stopped for about 6 months, but another letter was delivered early last month, which led to a clue, which led to 30-year-old Tarisha Lucas, a black woman.
Oh, my gosh.
Arrested this past Wednesday, charged with 8 counts of terroristic threats and acts. She made her first court appearance yesterday morning in bond court and was denied bond.
Good. We don't do that here.
East Carolina University, there was a fake racist social media post promoting a rush party. The post essentially for this rush party said no blacks. Well, investigators determined that a individual named James Edwards, who is black, who had no affiliation with the fraternity in question, he's a member of another fraternity, was the one who had posted this. He didn't have a comment until he's been arrested. He didn't have a comment until he obtained a lawyer. There was another hate crime hoax in St. Louis High School as well. This is how it goes. The left demands America be racist, and they will supply the hate artificially as needed, because without these sorts of incidents, in quotation marks, their moral authority is undermined because their narrative doesn't hold up under scrutiny, and support for their power grabs is dissipated.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. They're so desperate, and there's no racism there, so they have to create this narrative and lie and thankfully get arrested and get caught for doing it to try to make white people look racist.
Well, there's a demand for it, so the supply must come. The demand, because this is the basis of the claims that are being made for particular treatment, for particular benefits, for a particular curriculum. So if what they're saying about America isn't true, then what claim do they have? Then how could they demand support for supposed remedies to a problem that doesn't really exist? And this is not to say racism doesn't exist. We're talking about their argument of systemic, institutional, that persists and oppresses. That's what we're talking about. Not, you know, a one-off goofball who is a racist or utters something racist. We're talking about system, because that's what they're talking about. And they're predicating reordering America based on their claim. What if the claim is not true? Then what sort of basis do they have to compel people to reorder America? And so this brings us to critical race theory. And they're losing. And this is something people should be very encouraged by. And they may just lose a governor's race that they otherwise on paper should win based on what Virginia has become. But this race between Terry McAuliffe, who is one of the most disreputable people walking upright on the planet at present, but nonetheless, he's a Democrat socialist who's uber-connected inside the Beltway from his many years as a flack for the Democrat Socialist Party and being a former governor in a state that went for 10 points, went to Joe Biden for 10 points in 2020. Terry McAuliffe is in a dead heat with Youngkin, his Republican challenger, a wealthy businessman. And it's because they're losing the argument. And Terry McAuliffe is losing his marbles. Listen to this exchange between Terry McAuliffe and a black female reporter on one of the local stations in Virginia doing a Q&A with him about some of the issues in the race, particularly because, remember, Terry McAuliffe has now infamously said he doesn't want parents involved in telling schools what to teach, you know, or as Miguel Cardona might say, parents are one of the stakeholders in for their children. They're one of, not the primary. They're just a stakeholder as it pertains to their children. Well, McAuliffe asked about critical race theory by this reporter. Listen to this.
In school.
So how do you define it?
Anita, it is not taught here in Virginia.
But how do you define it?
Doesn't matter. It's not taught here in Virginia, so I'm not going to spend my time.
Your thoughts on what it is.
I'm not even spending my time because the school board and everyone else has come out and said it's not taught. It's racist. It's a dog whistle.
But if we don't have a definition, how can we say it's racist? I just want a definition from you.
It's not taught here in Virginia. We can ask about any topic. Here's what I've said all along, and it really bothers me. You know, it really bothers me. This whole idea of stirring parents up to create divisions. Our children are going through such challenges today because of COVID, and we're talking about something here today, wasting precious viewers' time.
That's really something. He's not very good at spin. I hope everybody picks up on it. One is, if you question the curriculum, you're racist. Two is, this. What is it? It doesn't matter what it is because it's not being taught. Well, if you don't know what it is, how do you know it's not being taught? Well, why can't you define it? It's not being taught. It's not being taught. This is the same thing we heard from the Loudoun County superintendent per Cheryl Atkinson's report earlier in the week.
Because I say it's not. They make these declarative statements. It's not being taught. There's no.
I have no opinion on CRT, he said. And then he went on to give his opinion of CRT, that it's a theory that only is taught in law schools and so on and so forth, which is, you know, basically cutting and pasting from the pundits on MSNBC. I mean, do you find that curious at all? You find that problematic? Somebody is making a statement. It is not being taught. I will not define it, but I know it's not being taught because somebody told me it's not being taught, because I believe it's not being taught, even though I won't tell you what I think it is. I mean, this is the quality of the argument that's being advanced as damage control for Terry McAuliffe in Virginia because of what's going on in Loudoun and Fairfax counties in particular. This should be very encouraging. He's coming apart at the seams as McAuliffe. I don't know if Youngkin wins. It's a dead heat right now, but it wasn't supposed to be a dead heat. Very interesting.
312-642-5600, turnkey DepPro answer line.
President Trump was on with our friend Sean Hannity last night, and he had this to say about the latest development on this front, which we've talked about all week. The memo from Merrick Garland to his minions at Department of Justice to game plan for interventions, federal law enforcement interventions, where threats are being made against local elected officials, specifically talking about rowdy school board meetings. And this is what the former president had to say.
The country can't take much more of it. They can't do it. When you look at those school boards, those are parents that love their country and they love their children, and they don't want all of this nonsense that's been being fed to their children. They just don't want it. And, you know, they're trying to make them out to be terrorists. It's actually, they use the term today. I saw it today that they're terrorists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Senator Rand Paul said Americans should be very afraid of our government. I mean, the fact that they're using the FBI to investigate alleged threats against school officials.
Well, I mean, how about the National Association of School Boards calling on the Patriot Act to be used to surveil parents? Peter Ducey asked Jen Psaki about that the other day.
The School Boards Association is asking for is for the administration to consider using the Patriot Act to investigate some of these school board protesters. So would the administration be okay with the FBI using the Patriot Act to surveil these parents if that is what they decide?
I don't speak on behalf of the National School Board Association. I speak on behalf of this government. The Attorney General has put out a letter. They will take actions they take, and I would point to them for more information.
Okay, well then send Peter Ducey over to the Department of Justice to ask Merrick Garland thing.
Parents are terrorists. Okay.
Patrick on the northwest side.
Dan, Amy, I officially had to pull my son out of CPS today.
Oh.
He went to Intrinsic. It's a charter public school. A male teacher approached him in the hallway asking about his sexual identity. Yesterday, my son was disturbed all day long, and he finally showed us a book they're teaching. It's called The Perks of Being a Wallflower. When it openly talks about masturbation, the teacher felt uncomfortable talking about it because it was class discussion on this. There are BLM, LGBTQ posters everywhere. My son objected, saying, I'm a Catholic. This is not right. But then they turn it back on him and saying he's being disrespectful for not going along with the pronouns. Cardinal Supich, where are you? If you're a Catholic school teacher, if you're Catholic and teaching this in the schools, you are guilty of a sin of omission for allowing this to happen to kids. This is outright satanic. They are proselytizing our children. Cardinal Supich, where are you?
Thanks for the call, Patrick. Best thing you did, getting your kid out of CPS. Mark in Northwest Indiana.
Hey, it's really hard to follow that. I plead for him for the Catholic Church Reformation. My comment is that these local hoaxes are one thing, but it's a symptom of a much larger issue with CRT as a hoax on this country. But also, don't forget January 6th. That was a hoax perpetrated by BLM, Antifa, and our own FBI, a racist hoax against this country as well. So just want to make that comment.
Well, to the extent to which – I mean, it's the whole thing wasn't a hoax. You obviously had people that behaved badly, and we've talked about it. I'm so sick of saying the same thing. Yeah, obviously, you don't support destruction of property. You don't support rioting. It was some erstwhile Trump supporters and so on and so forth. You don't confront police. You don't get into those showdowns that got into it. I mean, all of the things that a sixth grader could tell you, you know, keep your hands to yourself and so forth. Just stay arm's length apart, whatever. Okay. But with respect to the FBI, the whole question about their use of CIs or undercover agents in the run-up to that, given that they had information about potential disruption that day, and the whole question about how that information was shared between the sergeants at arms and the respective chambers and between the Capitol Police and so forth— that is all still very murky from my reading. And, so you want to have a 1-6 commission? Okay, fine, so long as it's so open-ended, appropriately open-ended, to address all of these questions about the law enforcement action prior to 1-6 and the law enforcement communication on 1-6 and the general response since on the other side of the criminal justice system too, in terms of the preservation of people's constitutional rights for due process as per those who were charged with crime. So, yeah, there's a lot of open questions about 1-6, the behavior of those who chose to break the law is clear. The behavior of those charged with enforcing the law, less clear. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Kristen Clark is the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, an important post within the AG's office. She was before Senate Judiciary Subcommittee to talk ostensibly about voting rights issues, but both Senators Ted Cruz from Texas and Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee took the occasion against the backdrop of this memo that Merrick Garland penned this week and disseminated, as we were discussing before Mike Scott's newscast, to ask Ms. Clark about her position with respect to federal legal intervention into school board meetings where there is disagreement over curriculum or COVID policy. Now, the backdrop of Kristen Clark, if you don't remember her confirmation hearing, she penned an op-ed as a lawyer activist in the private world. We must invest less in police and more in social workers. We must invest less in police and more in social supports in our schools. We must invest less in police and more in mental health aid. In other words, she supported defunding the police, although her spin at the time of her confirmation hearing was that she didn't have the power of the purse strings at that time. So she's not a supporter of defund the police, even though she was advocating for transferring resources from police to those other areas that I just mentioned. So just so you understand that she is a BLM devotee and activist who happens to be a lawyer, who happens to be Biden's choice to run the Civil Rights Division, the Department of Justice. This back and forth between Ted Cruz and Ms. Clark is illustrative.
Do you believe parents objecting to the teaching of critical race theory have civil rights in the democratic process?
I don't follow the question, Senator.
You don't understand the question whether parents objecting to critical race theory have civil rights?
The First Amendment is a core value in our democracy. And
I didn't say free speech. I said civil rights. School board meetings are democratic. That they are petitioning your local government. Do they have civil rights that the voting rights gives a damn about?
Yet they have the right to express their view, to challenge the school boards, to ask.
And is it beneficial for the Attorney General to label them as domestic terrorists and direct the FBI to target them?
The Attorney General's memo deals with threats against public servants and says that threats against public servants are not only illegal, they run counter to our nation's core values.
Do you believe parents objecting at school boards are domestic terrorists?
I don't, Senator.
Do you believe Antifa are domestic terrorists?
I don't have a view about Antifa.
Do you believe the Black Lives Matter protesters who burned shops, who firebombed police cars, who murdered police officers, do you believe they're domestic terrorists?
Senator, I believe that we live in a society where people espouse different views, but what we don't want are threats.
You know, Ms. Clark, it is amazing that you're not willing to condemn people who are murdering police officers and firebombing cities because your politics aligns with them. But at the same time, when it comes to parents at school boards, you're perfectly comfortable with calling a mom at a PTA meeting a domestic terrorist Ms. Clark, with all due respect, this demonstrates why the Democrat proposal to take someone with as long a partisan record as you have and to put you in charge of striking down any voting rights law in the country that you disagree with is nothing but a partisan power grab. Let me give another example, because your division.
Now, she did say, I don't consider parents objecting at school board meetings to be domestic terrorists, but it's hard to take her seriously, to take that position seriously, given her previous positions, her ideological disposition, and the memo emanating from her superior, that would be Attorney General Garland, and how that has been advocated for by the National Association of School Boards, and as you heard before the break, even going so far, the National Association of School Boards, to suggest possibly employing the Patriot Act. Federal legal intervention could take the form of invoking the Patriot Act to surveil these subversives parents at the school board level.
So moms are being told they're criminals and potential domestic terrorists. Okay.
Yeah, and you
that's
know,
it's not intimidating or anything when you're deciding whether or not to go.
Right, and in this climate where speech is violence, according to the left, you know, when Krista Clark says, "Well, people can petition their government, of course, or people have the right to express their views," you know, but so long as it doesn't run afoul of whatever the leftist minders consider hate speech or speech that is equivalent to violence, and they are redrawing those lines such that they're completely unrecognizable from Supreme Court jurisprudence on the topics. For more on this topic, pleased to be joined by David Deevil. He's the editor of Logos, a journal of Catholic thought and culture, co-director of the Terrence J. Murphy Institute for Catholic Thought, Law, and Public Policy, and visiting professor at the University of St. Thomas. David, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan and Amy.
Well, the culture the government schools just got that much more totalitarian this week, didn't it?
It certainly did. As they say, that escalated quickly.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and so the parental response, I mean, this is pretty intimidating, as Amy was saying, when you're having the Attorney General of the United States talking about the FBI. You've got the National Association of School Board recommending usage of the Patriot Act. So in other words, you better maybe don't go to the microphone at the next school board meeting. Maybe keep your thoughts to yourself.
That's right. They, the little clip you played a little bit earlier indicates, well, you know, we believe that parents have the right to petition their government. But, of course, if you're going to do that under the threat of being investigated by the FBI, that's not really a safe right, is it? Threats are certainly something that should not be made, but it didn't used to be the case that the FBI intervened in local threats. That was a local police matter. But ideology determines that we have to have the federal government intervene in these cases, because I think parents are winning in many cases at the local level.
Yeah, but are there any recorded acts of violence?
In the letter that the National School Board Association had, there were a couple of actual threats, but they included among these threats, parents calling school board members names or saying that they were wrong or that they were lying. So this is clearly not directed simply to threats. It's directed against any dissent from what school board members are saying.
Mm-hmm. And the response on the some of the issues that are being so hotly debated is that there's no point of any discussion here because we're not doing what you're saying we're doing. This is Terry McAuliffe's posture, the Virginia
right.
Dem governor candidate. Critical race theory isn't being taught. Well, can you define it? I don't need to define it because it's not being taught. Well, how do you know it's not being taught if you don't know what it is? Well, I just know. I mean, that to me sounds like a very desperate man, because he's up for election next month. And I don't think in Virginia, of all places, that Terry McAuliffe and the purveyors of critical race theory and this curriculum, I don't think they're winning.
No, I don't think they are. Chris Rufo at the Manhattan Institute, who's really done a lot to bring this out into the open, has pointed out in a recent City Journal article that the attempt to sort of peg any resistance to critical race theory, although we're not teaching it, but we really are, you know, to peg this as simply kind of anti-black or a backlash against civil rights is preposterous, because all the polling shows that it's not just white parents who don't like this, but it's black parents who don't like this. In Virginia, where, you know, you're talking about Terry McAuliffe, it's Hispanic and Asian parents who are very upset about this kind of teaching and this kind of approach, which racializes everything and punishes people who get on the wrong side of the progressive bureaucrats.
Well, and the idea that this doesn't exist, so I love this. It's the Loudoun County superintendents did the same thing. It's an arcane theory taught in some law schools. It doesn't exist, but let me go on and tell you why it's being characterized unfairly. Okay. So we see this. I mean, we had Paul Rossi on the show yesterday from Grace Church School in Manhattan. What he experienced is just one manifestation of it. I'm being asked to treat my students differently based on their race. I'm not going to do that. We saw a black female parent in an Atlanta area school sue her school because they were literally segregating kids by race. White kids with a white teacher and black kids with a black teacher at her kids' primary her grade school, basically. And she had to sue this. I mean, this is what we're talking about, and what you're describing is the racialization of everything. You want to get specific about specific theorists and argue the semantics of a proper definition of critical race theory. That's so beside the point. You know what you're doing. We see it in the PowerPoints. We see it in the indoctrination. We see it in incidents like Paul Rossi at Grace Church or this school in Atlanta. That's what we're talking about.
That's right. Anytime you start to see any of this language about, you know, white accountability or anything like that, you know what you're talking about. When you see these practices of segregating students, I believe the Atlanta woman you're referring to, you know, a black woman with kids in the school, and her husband even taught at the school, and she was shocked to find out that they didn't want her child in the class that was not the black class. It's really sick what we're doing here. We're moving far backwards on racial issues in the name of anti-racism, promoting segregation and the destruction of standards. And what really is at stake here is any kind of treatment of students and people as equals. And when they can't get equal outcomes, they start segregating, or in many cases, they get rid of standards altogether. I just saw a story yesterday about a school in Minnesota where I am that has now decided that no one can flunk any class.
Right. Yeah, that's going on here.
That's great, but we've all heard of social promotion for years, and it doesn't help anybody if you get through classes and you can't read or you can't do math. But in the name of equity, in the name of equal outcomes by race, we want to make sure that nobody fails because it might look bad. Instead of teaching black, white, Asian, Hispanic, and every other child in the world, we just say, well, we can't do it, so we'll just say that everybody's fine.
Having consequences for your actions is sometimes a really good thing.
That's right. Tom Sowell, the great economist who's been at the Hoover Institution for many years, talks about the fact that although it was not a good thing in the 1950s to grow up black, he was always glad that he did because there was none of this nonsense about, well, you know, that's good enough for you, young black man. Instead, he was challenged by people, and he became one of the greatest intellects of the last 50 years. But that doesn't happen now, all in the name, strangely, of anti-racism.
And unfortunately, this is not limited to the government school systems. We see this in Catholic schools and private schools generally as well. So you can't just say, oh, I'm going to take my kid out of the government school and send him to the local Catholic school. You got to do a deep dive on the local Catholic school these days, too.
That's correct. I mean, we had our kids in a charter school, and in Minnesota, charter schools are run as under the public school district, but they have separate boards. And it was very good for a long time, but then it fell. But then when our school went in this direction of critical race theory and critical gender theory, we had to look around at which schools we wanted to send our kids to, because there are many that are leaning in that direction. And they, you know, it goes under different terminology. As we pointed out, critical race theory, of course, they're not teaching it as a law school program, but social and emotional learning and all of these various things that get away from the idea that we're actually learning the material and you're going to be held accountable. So that's why I think so many people have been looking towards homeschooling and towards independent private and Catholic schools, because you have to be very, very careful about where you send your kids, because teachers are coming out of the same programs everywhere, and they're all learning the same stuff.
He is David Deville, editor of Logos, a journal of Catholic thought and culture. He's the co-director of the Terence J. Murphy Institute for Catholic Thought, Law, and Public Policy, and a visiting professor at the University of St. Thomas up Great White North, as he was describing, in Minnesota. David Deville, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560. The Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Anticipated 500,000 jobs created in September, and the number disappointing, 194,000 jobs created, according to the Department of Labor. That's the report out this morning. Unemployment rate drops to 4.8%, but we're still 22% down from the number of jobs we had pre-pandemic. And so the reaction to that from our next guest. But before we get his reaction to the jobs report, the debt ceiling, the latest debt ceiling theater, and this self-inflicted crisis is the watch phrase of the political class. Self-inflicted crisis averted because McConnell caved and helped cobble together a structured vote to bump up the debt ceiling for another few months. Janet Yellen, Captain Kangaroo impersonator, was on all week saying, essentially, this is a crisis and a self-inflicted one if we were to default. And, well, you know, my position is we should just get rid of this debt ceiling business altogether, because why even go through the pantomime of suggesting that anything should restrain our spending? We don't want our spending and borrowing restrained. We don't want to be forced to live within our means. So why even go through this? Because nobody else does either.
I think it's become increasingly damaging to America to have a debt ceiling. It's led to a series of politically dangerous conflicts that have caused Americans and global markets to question whether or not America is serious about paying its bills. It's flirting with a self-inflicted crisis.
Do you think that the global community might find the $30 trillion in debt and $100+ trillion in unfunded liabilities an indication that America may not be serious about paying its debts as well? That question rarely contemplated by folks like Janet Yellen. For more on the topic and the jobs report as well, please be joined again by James Perry. He's the Senior Vice President and Partner at Arbor Research. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Thank you very much.
What about this debt ceiling business? Should we just agree with Jamie Dimon and Janet Yellen and let's just call the whole thing off already?
No, I think it's nonsense. I mean, you know, the fact is it's dead. And debt has to be repaid. And if they don't want to call it debt and they want to call it credit, that's a whole other story, and it becomes a political deal. But right now, it's, I guess Janet Yellen is correct, or you are, by saying that, you know, nobody else does it either. The Japanese have been doing this, and their debt-to-GDP ratios are in the 350% range. Ours is sort of, you know, 138 or something percent. So
right, but the trend. The point of the debt ceiling is theoretically, it doesn't actually work in practice, but the point is to put some handcuffs so we don't get to Japanese level, right, so that we are forced to live within our means. But so I'm agreeing with Jana Reno and Jamie Dimon for different reasons. I just think there's nobody interested in living within our means. So, you know, why go through this kabuki theater?
Yeah, I agree. It's gotten surreal, to be honest.
So, all right, let's get to the jobs number. 194,000 jobs, well below the ADP estimate. What's an economist's estimates? What are we to make of the importance of that number?
Right. Well, in August, the number was revised to 366, and we come in today at 194. So that's a significant deceleration. But prior to that, the June number was 850,000. And the July number was 934,000 new jobs. So the big question to everybody's mind was August a blip, and are we going to recover so that we can taper? And today's information, today's data says that this is not a blip. This is a formidable change in the labor force. This is a structural change in the labor force. It's a transformational change. And I think that the message really is, the U.S. economy is not going to return to normal anytime soon, and it won't look the same as it did before the pandemic.
Well, will it ever rebound? Or you're saying that this is just a new way of doing business?
Well, I don't know if it's a new way of doing business. I think it's a new way of the way people live their lives. I mean, the trouble is that the pandemic was a tremendous disruption. It's affected every aspect of how and where people work and where they live and what activities they engage in. And the fact is that they don't really want to go back to work. I think that the phrase that people use is the new absenteeism,
And we had President Biden in town. I just want to run this by you, talking about our economy and vaccinations, how they're tied together.
The unvaccinated also put our economy at risk because people are reluctant to go out. Think about this. Even in places where there is no restriction on going to restaurants and gyms and movie theaters, people are not going in anywhere near the numbers because they're worried they're going to get sick. I've tried everything in my power to get people vaccinated.
What are your thoughts on that?
I don't know. I try not to listen to them. It's just a script. It's political. I don't know. What I would say is that, I'm looking at this non-farm payroll number and I broke it down in a lot of different varieties, but the fact is that the number one loss of jobs in this last month, in September, was 123,000 government employees, right? Huh. So the government employees, and these are, to be honest with you, they're mainly teachers, right? They do not want to go back to work. And whether they are using the pandemic and as a fear excuse, maybe they just don't want to do it. I don't know what it is, but they're not going to go back to work. And parents really don't want their kids going to school either. I think the stay at home, Dan, we talked about this the last time I was on. There was a poll in the New York Times that polled New York City households with children, and 25% of them said they're going to homeschool their kids. So, if you add that on top of the shortage of daycare workers, parents are going to stay home. Employment at daycare centers is still 20% below pre-pandemic level. Wow. You can't drop your kids off, right? So I think this is a whole new deal, and it's going to go on for a while.
Yeah, and it's interesting, though, because it doesn't necessarily implicate corporate profitability. You could perhaps be finding corporations doing more with fewer, being more profitable with fewer, and then this is, as you say, sort of a transition, at least in some sectors, in terms of the way business is conducted. So it seemed unclear to me whether this signals a slowing down of the recovery in terms of GDP growth. What's your sense of what this is or isn't signaling on that score?
I think you're absolutely right, Dan. I mean, corporate profitability really is under pressure here between, having to pay higher prices for raw materials and goods that go into the manufacturing of their product, or for higher labor. The fact is that, profit margins are coming down. And I think that you're going to start getting corporate profitability reports, earnings per share reports here in the next week or two or three. And the big fear is that, you know, margins are being squeezed and companies, especially in services, really can't raise prices without losing market share because you've got these big cap titans out there that can come in and deliver what you're doing for cheaper because they've got the platforms to do it. So I'm a little bit worried about corporate profitability. And I would say that, you know, this whole thing dovetails into, as we talked about, the primary economic concern involves the rising of the cost of money and how much of it the Fed is willing to provide the post-pandemic recovery. And the fact is, we just don't know how strong the recovery is right now. We had a huge hit in 2020, huge recovery in 2021, and now it looks like economic activity is going to be shorter, smaller, weaker than where we were pre-pandemic. And I'm talking about 5 to 10 million jobs short with an output gap in GDP of at least 1 or 2%.
Well, and then against that backdrop, if that's what comes to pass and that's sustained, you have both the Fed and the European Central Bank moving in the direction of tapering, getting out of the business of essentially propping up the markets. So then are we looking at like a Q1, Q2 that could raise the specter of the Carterism stagflation?
That's a good question. Timing's really tricky. I will say this. My biggest problem is that I don't embrace the narrative that the Fed can begin to taper when the economy is slowing. And the Fed's forecast for GDP and inflation by Q1 next year is substantially lower than it is now. GDP, they're talking about 2.5% or 3%, and inflation, they're talking about 2% in 6 to 9 months. So how do you raise rates when they know that the economy is going to slow down? I think Powell was kind of nudged into talking about transitory versus permanent price increases, especially with this energy crisis that's going on in China and Europe. But I'm not sure he really believes it. Every trader on the planet recognizes that prices are going up. Every trader. But investors are looking past all of this stuff and saying, you know, things like used car prices, are they really going to go up 50% again next year? You know, I don't think so. Are semiconductor prices really going to go up 30% or 40% again next year? I don't think so. So investors look at things differently than traders, and all the trader talk you hear on TV is what makes the news. But investors are looking past this and thinking that things are going to slow down a little bit. So,
well, so a contraindicator this week, you know, because in addition to supply of labor being an issue, supply of goods is a big issue. And so, you know, and all the talk last week about the bottleneck of cargo ships in Long Beach. But we saw the price of a 40-foot shipping container come down dramatically. Does that indicate that some supply chain issues are being worked out and that goods are flowing more freely?
I think so. I mean, you know, the biggest problem, I would say the weakest link in the supply chain is humans, right? I mean, there's this thing called the bullwhip effect. And what that means basically is, you know, somebody puts in one large order unexpectedly and he sets off a wave of panic buying and inventory building. And the effects multiply along the supply chain all the way back to the factory. And that has happened. And, you know, container ships cost $1,500 to rent, you know, 2 years ago. And they went up to 15,000. And all of a sudden that 15,000 number is down to 8, right? So I think, and, you know, you look at a lot of commodities that are really sort of indicators of economic growth, things like lumber and copper. You know, they went up and they're down as much as they went up. And it took about 4 months to do it. And the only reason steel and aluminum aren't doing that is because the Chinese don't have enough energy to make the stuff, right? So there's a shortage. But everything else is going down, except oil. And oil and energy. Coal and oil, I don't understand. I think it's I think people are going to need it a lot longer through the winter, and that's a problem. So I just don't know. I think it's a slowdown story rather than an inflation story.
Slowdown story rather than inflation story. Okay. He is Jim Perry, Senior Vice President and Partner at Arbor Research. Jim, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Dan and Amy, this tweet from pro-abortion writer, formerly of GQ, and now she's doing her own thing, Julia Ayeff.
Yeah.
Listen to this. If you're anti-choice and want to make sure every woman carry every pregnancy to term, why not make the person who created the pregnancy contribute? Why not have men pay child support to the women they impregnate? Surely it is not the woman's responsibility alone.
What?
So what you're saying is that men should be responsible for the children they create too? You know what? That's just crazy enough to work. That is just crazy enough to work. It's almost like Julia Ayeff is completely unfamiliar with the actual views of pro-life, pro-family conservatives. What pro-lifer is ever argues for men to walk away from their
responsibilities.
Fatherly responsibilities for the children that they foster, you know, that they create, co-create. This is talk, you know, how thick is your bubble? How dense is your silo?
How deep
That's,
is
those
your
are the questions for Julia Ayeff.
It's like a hot steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Open mic! Open mic Friday! Call in now! Open mic Friday!
Yeah, it's that time of the week, Open Mic Friday. Dan and Amy taking your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Comments, compliments, criticisms, general crack pottery, it's all welcome.
Well, you know, I'd like to start first because it's ladies first, right?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Because you said something, because you know, all day long we heard yesterday that San Francisco, the mayor's dropping the indoor mask mandate because their cases are so low. Their positivity rate is at an all-time low. They think they have it under control. But you know what it was? You're right. It was all political because Mayor Breed got caught dancing all night long without her mask on at a bar in San Francisco.
I had a good time at the Black Cat, and I think it's sad that this is even a story. The fact is, there was something that was really monumental that occurred.
Monumental.
And that is Tony.
Tony!
The original members, the brothers, Rafael Saadiq and Dwayne Wiggins, who have not performed in public for, I believe, at least over 20 years.
Oh, my God.
They are just really some of the most incredible artists in the history of this country and the Bay Area in particular. And the fact that that is getting lost here is very unfortunate.
Oh, it's terrible. It feels good. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah, it feels good. Take your mask off.
And look, no one is disputing how good
God.
Tony is.
But give me a break.
And, you know, I appreciate Leonard Bree recognizing, you know what, we need to just get rid of the masks so that people can focus on Tony's resurgence. And by whatever reason, I'll take it.
Yeah,
but I still wouldn't move to San Francisco.
No, and their positivity rate is 1.7, just in case you care, Dan.
Before we get to our callers, I did want to answer this a question that has dogged man since the automobile became central to our lives. Does auto insurance policy cover spreading STD when having sex in a car?
That's
a great question.
No, you know what? That really is an interesting question.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a suit that's been filed. Unnamed parties, MO, demanded that Geico pay her $1 million to resolve her claim against MB because MO and MB got busy in the car, and apparently MB gave MO HPV, and she believes, well, I'm assuming it's a she, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know MO. But that party believes that the auto insurance umbrella policy should cover the STD.
I say N-O, because the car didn't give you the STD. The man did.
Well, the substantive case has yet to be resolved. But just an interesting legal note here. One of the procedural issues is whether M.O. and M.B. can retain their anonymity, particularly M.O. in pursuing this case. And while GEICO is seeking a declaratory judgment as to their rights and responsibilities under their coverage, the judge ruled that M.O. and M.B. cannot maintain their anonymity. Oh. So they're going to have to put their names on the record if they want to and make it, and thus it's a public record. And we could get into knowing just exactly who these two individuals are and perhaps attributing whatever did transpire in that car to them, you know, by name.
Yeah. Can you imagine a GEICO commercial with a disclaimer? Not responsible for STDs transmitted in cars.
Yeah. What is that little gecko going to have to say
about
this?
Hi, what are you doing in that?
Yeah. So there you go. So first, if you're going to, we don't know yet if STD transmission in a car is covered by your auto policy. I think we have an idea where that might go, but we don't know yet. But we do know that if you're going to file such a claim, you can't do so anonymously. So let that be a lesson to all you kids out there. All right, let's go to Roland in Arlington Heights. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, guys. Long time, no talk.
Yeah.
This is where parenting status becomes a factor in criminal trial voir dire.
Hello?
Okay, Roland.
Okay, also, we have now opened up a new channel of closing arguments for criminal defense attorneys.
How is that? I feel like I'm deposing you. Go ahead.
All right, this is where a defense attorney can now introduce a political aspect to criminal trials.
So you're saying a defense attorney can claim what on behalf of his client to get him off the hook? What be specific?
Okay. All right. He can claim that we have now a parent, presumably without a criminal background, who is now being charged just because of Merrick Garland's memo.
Oh, I see. Oh, you're talking about Garland. Okay. All right. Thanks for the call, Roland.
Took a long time to get there, but we got there.
Bob in Edison Park.
Yeah, guys, I'd like to just talk about the duplicity or the stupidity of the Republican Party over the last 50 years, and I'm going to point out Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz made a great speech to that woman about critical race theory and the government getting involved and basically labeling you a terrorist. However, Ted Cruz was the biggest supporter of the Patriot Act and FISA, where Rand Paul, on the contrary, who has been phenomenal and has always been phenomenal and never changed, has always been against the Patriot Act. Even I, as an idiot, and Ted Cruz was, I think he was, they wanted him for the Supreme Court at one time because he's such a great jurist. Well, even an idiot like me, Dan, and I'm not a smart guy, even an idiot like me saw when this Patriot Act was being pushed through that the potential for abuse was phenomenal. Why didn't Ted Cruz see that? Maybe his Goldman Sachs connections told him not to. And one quick other point, and I'll get off. It's a different point. These parents are kind of making me sick, guys. Because you know what? It's always the school, the school, the school. And I agree. My kids went to government schools and they were horrible. But these parents, they have given up their responsibility a long time ago. Every problem, and I've brought this up before on your show, I know a lot of conservative people, and their kids are stone freak libs. And it's like, oh, it was the school. Oh, it was the friends. Well, my children, guys, they went to the same school, had pretty much the same friends. These parents have given up their responsibility a long time ago, and now in a lot of cases, and I'm not defending the schools, But in a lot of cases, they use the schools as an excuse. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I mean, in terms of, you know, wanting to offload blame after you've offloaded your kids and oversight of your kids. You know, maybe some parents didn't appreciate what was happening until recently. I think a lot of people didn't until the last few years, maybe even the last few months. So I think it's a fair criticism, but I also want to encourage parents to claw back, even if they were asleep at the switch for a time. Hey, as long as you have awakened now and you see what's happening and you're going to do something about it, then it's sort of, you know, a better late than never thing. So, yeah. I mean, it's a fair criticism, but it shouldn't mean that you do nothing because you were absent for so long. Let's get present. Kirk and Roselle.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
Great.
Good. You know, what I just wanted to talk a little bit about was the unemployment report that came out today. And I'm sure they're going to brag about it. And I feel that that unemployment report is just totally underreported because it's only reporting those who file for unemployment. So as they're letting people go for not getting vaccinated, those people are not going to be able to file for unemployment. What happens to those people? Are they not reported in any way?
Well, yeah, I mean, in terms of, thanks for the call, Kirk, in terms of first-time filers for unemployment benefits, right, I think that will, to some extent, vary state by state, where some states are taking more aggressive approaches against those who were either suspended without pay or fired for not complying with the vaccine mandate. So, right, I mean, I'm not sure how much the unemployment rate number means. We talked about this many times with Scott Shirley. I'm not sure how much it really tells you anyway. I think you have to dig into the numbers and the dynamics at play to get a better understanding of what's actually happening. So, those displaced because of the mandates and those who continue to choose to be displaced because of welfare state benefits, maybe more on the way. Are those sort of externalities in getting a true picture of the labor participation in this country? Yeah, they are. It's a good point. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Oh, hi, guys. How has your golf game been lately, Dan? Just curious.
I've had a couple of decent rounds of late, but it's...
You've got longest drive for your tournament. Hello?
It's not something to write home about.
Yeah, you got a beautiful crystal trophy you brought
in. It's still very precarious, like the economy.
Very precarious. Okay, well, my game's getting a lot better. I've been practicing playing. So I'm doing okay, but I'm still learning this pickleball game, too. And so I thought it was funny, the social justice warriors out here in Western Springs, which I can sometimes be one of, got the courts regulated enough in at least my little corner of town so we can get on the court. You hang your racket. You do all that stuff. Remember that from the old days, you guys, when you hung your racket on the thing? Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, you wore a tag on your gym shoe. So we can get on the court. We can actually play. And I just wanted to invite you and see if you wanted to get a day pass out to Western Springs and see if you want to come
in. Sure, day pass.
Try some pickleball.
Do I have to wear an oppressor T-shirt or anything in Western Springs?
No, you can wear all black. You know, you can put on a hat, disguise yourself. Just come on out and give it a whirl, because I'm really good at hitting it. I don't know how to score, though, but I can play singles, and I think it's a blast. It's a great workout. Come on out and play.
All right. Thanks for the invite, Mary Kay. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there it is. That's me. That's my highlight reel.
That's pickleball.
That is pickleball.
No, that's tennis.
That is pickleball. Yes, it's pickleball.
Really?
Yes.
Doesn't sound like
tennis
pickleball.
Is more ball. A deeper sound.
You do a great impersonation of a tennis ball, by the way.
You don't. Have you played pickleball yet?
Yeah, I played it once.
Okay.
I think I'm gonna pick it up.
I gotta tell you, from watching you play volleyball, you'd be a great pickleball player.
Well, I'm basically Jim Thorpe of my generation.
All right, easy there. Jeez.
Billy in Western Springs. The other guy in Western Springs who listens to the show. Person. Hey, Billy.
Billy. Billy, Billy.
Billy.
Hold up, Billy.
All right, we'll put Billy Baru back on hold. Bye. Dawn in Plainfield.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my phone call. Can you close the door, buddy? Okay, I'm sorry.
Yes, ma'am.
Wow, you're assertive.
I'm sorry. No.
Happened to please close the door?
You had brought up Justice Robert earlier in the week in regards to the upcoming abortion case that's coming up. And Justice Roberts had written a decision in March of 2017 in the Andrew F. and Brown decision. And basically what it was a kid that was passed through the school system from grade to grade without doing any grade level work. And Justice Roberts wrote that we should have the same expectation for all children. If we have the same expectation for kids who don't have a disability to progress a grade level, then we should have the same expectation for children with a disability. And if not, then they're receiving a de minimis education. So my point is that the K-12 school system that claims to wear the robes of justice and equality, the reality is the Andrew F. case. That's the reality, that they're passed on from grade to grade without doing grade level work. So they don't wear the robes of equality. They wear the robes of de minimis. They de minimize life, and they de minimize kids who have a disability, and they de minimize the poor. That's my comment for the week. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Dawn. Appreciate that. Margo in Burr Ridge.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking the call. I just wanted to make sure that all your listeners in Hinsdale, Willowbrook, Darien, that they all know that District 86, which is the high school district, has bought and is implementing the Panorama Education package.
Oh, Merrick Garland's son-in-law. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we're all enriching Merrick Garland and his family with our huge property taxes. So
and gaslighting the kids about shocked. Race. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Anyway, thanks for letting me let people know.
Thanks for the call, Margo. Good. Yeah, it's nice to hear. Glad Merrick Garland's family's doing so well. Remember Merrick the Moderate? We were told.
Oh, that's right.
Merrick the Moderate, who's tasking federal law enforcement to go after parents. Okay. Ryan, Downers Grove.
Hey, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking my call. Mary Kay totally stole my comment. I was going to call in for a special edition of This Week in Golf with Dan Proft because I saw your post on Facebook earlier this week, Dan. But I figured it was a good time to either hear about the tournament or just a good opportunity to highlight the wonderful work that Envision Unlimited does. Thank you for your leadership and getting the word out on that organization. Would love to get more involved with that. But thanks guys for all you do. Really, really appreciate you. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Ryan. Yeah, so Envision is one of the Chicago's biggest service providers for people with intellectual and or developmental disabilities. They do day programming. They have CILAs, meaning living spaces for people with disabilities where there's 24-hour, 7-day-a-week care, and they just do a great job. And it's basically, for those who don't know, it's like Misericordia, but it's mainly for indigent adults who've aged out of the system. Okay. Not that they got great service from the state when they were in the system, but who've aged out. And so, Envision does the Lord's work, just like Misericordia and so many other organizations do. In terms of my golf, thank you for asking.
I want to break it down now.
Well, here's the – so I shot 75 at Black Sheep on Tuesday, and I shot 76, as did Mayor Keith Peacock of Orland Park. You shot 76 to North at Olympia Fields on Monday for our little golf outing for Envision. But I'm just way too many mistakes, too many long putts or even bogeys from 120 yards in. That's my problem right now.
My problem is my golf is just too good right now.
That's your problem?
That's my problem. No, it's not a problem. It's a blessing. Yeah, I played a 9-hole scramble at Merowitz for Amundsen High School. I got closest to the pin. And our team won. We were 1 under par.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
You got closest to the pin on the hole with the windmill?
No.
Chuck and Dullivan, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I got free tees
for I got cheated out of $109 last night in downtown Sharon playing bingo. I didn't call bingo on the number that was called, and the guy wouldn't give me the money. And then he turned around and told me, he said, well, that's what we're regulated by the state. I go, dude, I told the bar owner, I says, you got a better chance of seeing Moses than seeing me in here ever again. Hey, guys, this weekend, get up to Flatiron Park. They got a big festival, Oktoberfest, downtown Lake Geneva. I'm picking up my girlfriend when she gets off work at the bottle shop, and we're going to go dancing. So come live for me.
You're such a good dancer.
All right. Thanks for the call, Chuck. Next time, let me know where you're playing bingo, and I'll send Rocco Moose to make sure they can help the judge find his wallet. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.